The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
And I think the next few decades, we may see some of the science fiction dreams we've had actually come true.
Astronomy journalist Stuart Clark joins me to discuss why the UK government has just put £60 million into cutting-edge rocket technology. There might also be talk of super massive black holes. And...
I was at Astrium's laboratories in Stevenage last week, and I... saw the Mars Successor, the ExoMars robot engineering probe, and I got to drive it over a pseudo-Martian surface.
That's very cool.
Has a pseudo-Martian surface.
It has indeed, yes.
I'll be joined by the Guardian science team to discuss some of this week's other stories, including a radical, promising new way to tackle genetic abnormalities such as Down syndrome, and the latest from the NASA Mars Curiosity rover, which is telling us all about the atmosphere on the red planet. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The British aerospace industry got a rocket-style boost this week to the tune of £60 million. The main beneficiary of the investment was a UK firm called Reaction Engines. They've been working on a remarkable technology, the Sabre rocket, which might just change our image of what we think of as space planes. To tell me more, we've got Stuart Clark in the studio. He's the author of the Guardian's Across the Universe blog. Welcome back to the podcast, Stuart.
Hi, Alok. Thanks for having me.
Oh, very, very, very wonderful to see you here. And as I was saying earlier, you look like you just come from some... safari in Africa. Well, what have you been up to?
It's the weather for it.
Yes. It's very hot here in London, which is rare. We should probably stop complaining about the weather, shouldn't we? Let's talk about this amazing space plane. So £60 million invested by the government into a company called Reaction Engines, a very British company this, and you wrote this fantastic blog post all about their dream. What's their dream for space?
Their dream for space is that they build space planes, essentially. So these are things that will take off from a runway just like a normal aircraft, and they will essentially fly into orbit. They will deploy their payload or take astronauts to the ISS. They will then fly back down, land on a runway. There will be only routine maintenance needed, no rebuilding, no refurbishment or anything like that, just refueling. And off they go again. They're hoping to have this turnaround of getting to and from space in about 48 hours. And the key to it, as you said, is the Sabre engine.
So, well, I mean, I can already see a few problems in the fact that taking a plane from a runway on the surface of the Earth all the way to the space station, you have a change in atmosphere in that you go from lots of atmosphere to... well, none, planes flying on the Earth, they require air to be going through their engines constantly, whereas the reason you use massive rockets to get into space is because you carry your own fuel. I mean, I'm assuming they've thought of these things.
Absolutely. This is the genius of it. This is the genius of Alan Bond, the man who's really behind Reaction Engines. Essentially, if you could fly a plane fast enough to about 25 times the speed of sound, you would be going so fast that you would just fly straight out of the atmosphere. Now, to go at that speed in the atmosphere, we're very familiar with what happens with rockets when they re-enter and they have the big heat shields to stop them burning up. So somehow you have to stop your plane burning up, essentially.
Bursting into flames on the way out.
They have developed part of the Sabre engine to cool the air that is going into the engine. That stops the engine melting. And this makes a super efficient jet engine that will get them to about Mach 5. So once they get to this five times faster than the speed of sound, then they close the air intakes and they turn Sabre into a rocket, which boosts them. They tilt the plane up. And then they just go. And the reason this works for them is because getting to Mach 5 through the air-breathing engines, taking the air in, means that they don't have to carry huge tanks of oxidizer to burn the fuel.
And that's what a lot of the weight of a rocket is. And that you see, you know, the Atlas rockets or the Ariane, for example, when they launch, a lot of the energy goes into just the first bit of the launch, and then as they get up into higher and higher into the atmosphere, bits of the rocket fall off to sort of get rid of the mass. Now, the Sabre engine, how much testing have they done of this to actually? Have they got one into space yet? It sounds like one of those science fiction things that you want to be true, but the reality might bite sometimes.
Well, they have now passed a series of critical tests for the heat exchangers and various key technology parts for this engine. And they haven't just done it themselves and we take their word for it. All these tests were supervised by the engineers from the European Space Agency. And they have given all the key technology a completely clean bill of health. It does what it says on the tin. So now the 60 million is to actually build a Sabre prototype and test it end to end like that. And then
get it into space.
Probably not into space, but just to get the engine working completely. And then hopefully that's the pathway through then into commercial production.
What's in it for the UK government? Why have they put so much money into this at a time when, you know, everything else is being cut?
Because this is utterly world-leading technology. No one else can do this.
We say that a lot for lots of things, but this really is, isn't it?
This truly, truly is, yes. Yeah, it's one of those overused things that we say, but this truly is a game changer, and it truly is something that is only available in the UK. And the beauty of it is it's kind of like the backroom boys all over again. These guys have been down in Oxfordshire working just in a small industrial unit for 20 years on this dream, and they're clever guys. And now they've done it.
Why are more people not doing this then? It sounds like something that, if it worked, would be incredible. And from what you're saying, it sounds like, you know, there are challenges ahead, but it has a really good chance. So why isn't NASA or the European Space Agency putting 60 million is not even that much money for them?
No, so NASA have had a go at space planes, and they've been trying to develop planes that could fly really hypersonically. Bond's genius was realizing that to get rid of the heat in a jet engine travelling at Mach 10, Mach 15 is next to impossible. So he realised that all he needed to do with the jet engine was the heavy lifting through the bottom of Earth's gravity up to a nice altitude and Mach 5, and then a smaller rocket engine could really do the rest of the job for you. So it's a hybrid design, the Sabre engine, whereas before people have just thought they'd build a hyper-efficient jet that would do it, and that hasn't worked.
Are NASA interested in this at all? Do
I'm
you know?
I'm sure NASA are very, very interested.
They've probably
in
sort of
this.
Had their head whipped round by the investment, haven't they? How does things like Sabre and the plane that this is going to go on, the Skylon, how do these compare to like the space tourism options we've seen recently? So Spaceship Two is going to have its first paying customers for a low Earth orbit very soon. That's also an interesting design.
Absolutely. These are completely different in magnitude. So Spaceship Two, for example, will get to suborbital space. It will go just over 100 kilometres up. And there's no real definition of where space begins, but 100 kilometres up is a pretty good one to use. And
isn't that far, actually, if you think about it.
It's not that far, no.
Is it about 60 miles or something?
It was the classic Fred Hoyle quote, where he said that if you could drive to space in about an hour if your car could go straight up. It's not far. The space planes, however, will have to go to low Earth orbit, and that's sort of more than 200 kilometres high. Anything up to 2,000 kilometres high, in fact, is a low Earth orbit. So the Hubble Space Telescope, that's at 500 kilometres altitude. And getting that extra distance and achieving orbit is a big deal, actually. So these are completely bigger in scope than the space tourism things.
So if things work out, when can we see Skylon docking with the International Space Station?
Well, they're hoping for test flights now in sort of the 2019 time frame, and sort of 3 or 4 years later after that, they're hoping for flights to the International Space Station. So potentially this could happen very quickly now, and that has to be exciting.
And it's exciting also that private space flight is really taking off now, isn't it? Excuse the pun. I mean, it really is happening, and it's so exciting because there's so many new technologies. And we talked about Spaceship Two. It is also a fantastic thing, and they want to get to the space station too as well. Ultimately, they want to get payloads into space, satellites and things. And then you have the Jeff Bezos and people trying to get to Mars just by themselves. It's like an exploration boom, isn't it? And it's all kind of risky, and it shows that people are willing to take these risks, which NASA and ESA just probably would never have taken.
Yes, I think we're in a new space race. I think that's very, very clear now. And there are all these different ideas. There's Elon Musk's idea of the totally reusable three-stage rocket, and there's fantastic videos of these rocket stages doing sort of vertical takeoff and landings, you know, going up 300 meters and things like this.
And they develop so fast.
Yeah, having got used to sort of government development of space technology, I'm staggered at how fast this is going. Sometimes it makes me worry a little bit that it's going a bit too fast. But it is. It's like the early days of aviation. It's almost like the early space race between Russia and America again, except now we're seeing it in private industry because they believe they can turn profits.
I mean, the thing is, these guys, as you say, the early aviation example is a good one. You have from the Wright brothers, you know, and the plane they built in the beginning of the 20th century to the middle of the 20th century when you had fighters in World War II doing the things they were able to do. I mean, that was barely 40 years. And imagine if with modern technology what you could do with 40 years of space planes would be remarkable. I'm a bit afraid to dream about it because we've dreamt about this before and nothing happened.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you're right. And the difference, I think, this time, the difference that I'm kind of pinning my hopes on is that this time it's private industry who are driven by the need to turn a profit. They're also obviously driven by a need for safety, because if you have accidents, then your company goes down and no one gets any profit. So it's a slightly false argument to say that they'll cut corners and risk and safety. But it is risky, and I think the next few decades we may see some of the science fiction dreams we've had actually come true.
Talking of one of my science fiction dreams, it's to visit a black hole. this was one of your other most popular posts this week. Since we're doing this, we might as well, since we have you here, we've got to talk about this. There's a supermassive black hole in the centre of our galaxy. We know that. Sagittarius A star, I believe it's called. And it just ate something recently, and we're all very excited about it. What happened?
So in 2011, astronomers discovered a cloud of gas that was falling towards the black hole at the centre of our galaxy. And they're always looking at the central regions and looking at the way the stars orbit the black hole, because you can't see the black hole, but you can infer where it is by the way the stars move. And they've now got some pretty good estimates for the size of the black hole, about 4 million times the mass of the sun, and the size of the black hole, about 7 billion kilometers across. Well, they saw this cloud that was falling towards it, and this cloud contains enough gas to produce about 3 planet Earths. And so they've been monitoring it to see what happens as it gets close to the black hole. You know, will it sort of whip round and come out the other side? Will part of it fall in or not? And they were surprised to see that a bit of it arrived earlier than they thought, and it survived. It's gone round the back of the black hole. It's coming back out towards us again. And this means that this cloud, the gravity of the black hole, has just stretched it out into this long kind of, you know, great big kind of spaghetti type shape. The rest of the cloud will now pass around the black hole over the next year or so. Almost certainly some of that will fall into the black hole. And this would be very exciting to actually see the nearest supermassive black hole to us feeding and see what actually
what
happens.
What happens when stuff goes into the black hole, though?
Well, if it were to fall straight into the black hole, nothing. It would be there 1 minute and gone the next. However, things tend to sort of spiral in, and so this black hole is surrounded by a disk of gas that's all swirling around, like water around a plug hole that's gradually falling in. And that disk is extremely bright because it's extremely hot. So probably what will happen is that some of this cloud will hit that disk and join with that disk, And what we anticipate is that when it hits the disk, it will give off a flare of radiation. And we will look to see if this is like it's coming from the center of certain galaxies called active galaxies. And there we see very bright radiating cores. And we think that's because its black holes are feeding actively all the time in those galaxies.
I mean, I suppose it also gives us some insight into how black holes, well, black hole mechanics basically as well. You don't get to see much of this in action because they're black.
Absolutely. So, and watching the movement of stars and gas around in the close vicinities of these black holes can allow us, in some cases, to test general relativity as well, our best theory of gravity so far.
Well, Stuart, thank you very much for that. I mean, between space planes and supermassive black holes, I mean, seriously, I mean, you've definitely got the best writing gig there is.
I'm a very lucky man.
You are. Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome.
Time for some news now, and with me in the studio are The Guardian's Ian Sample. Ian, welcome.
Hello.
Open University's Dr. Natalie Starkey, who's a cosmochemist. We'll be asking about what that means later.
Hello.
And Robin McKee, the Year Observer's science editor. Welcome, Robin.
Hi there.
Now, we're going to start with Ian, a very interesting story in Nature last week about how Down syndrome was potentially fixed in the cells of some, in a culture dish, essentially. So tell us what this story is about.
Down syndrome is caused by having an extra chromosome 21 in your cells. So normally you just have two pairs of chromosomes, 2 × 23 chromosomes in your cells. Down's comes about when you have three lots of chromosome 21. And that brings about a whole bunch of disorders and conditions which are lumped together as Down syndrome. There are probably about 80 different things that you can put together that become Down syndrome. What this group did was really fascinating, actually. They used a technique called genome editing on Down syndrome cells. So they took cells from Down syndrome patients, and they used this process called genome editing, which basically allows you to cut and paste DNA into chromosomes and things. And they dropped in a gene called EXIST, which normally lurks on the X chromosome. And what it does is only active in women, and it shuts down one of the copies of the X chromosome that women have. Women are obviously XX, men are XY, so women don't need two X's, so this shuts down one of them.
So this EXIST, that's XIST, that's the name
right.
of the chromosome.
That's
the name of the gene, rather.
Yeah, so they took this EXIST gene from the X chromosome, dropped it in on the extra chromosome 21 in Down syndrome cells. And lo and behold, what it does is it churns out a load of RNA, which essentially cover that extra chromosome. And it brings about these epigenetic effects. It causes the chromosome, the surfaces, to sort of rearrange a little bit, if you like. And it has the effect of almost completely shutting down that extra chromosome. So what you're doing in those cells is you're actually reverting them back to having effectively only two chromosome 21s instead of three. And if you look at how these cells fare, they grow a lot better. They turn into neural cells a lot better. And they essentially seem far healthier. Now, the reason this was exciting was it was the first sniff, as one scientist put it to me, of even thinking about a gene therapy for either some of the disorders brought about by Down syndrome or for Down syndrome itself.
How would you use this in gene therapy, though? Would it have to be something at the developmental stage, or do you put it into babies that have already been born?
Yeah. So this group now is trying in mice to cure all of Down syndrome in that animal. And what they're doing there is they're going to do this genome editing on early stage embryos. Now, what they need to do then is get this silencing gene into all of the cells or most of the cells of an embryo as it's growing. Now, that you're not going to be able to do that in for humans. It's not even on the table. The idea that you would be doing a gene therapy of an embryo in the womb is just, you know, it's not going to happen. So that is off. I think that, you know, maybe in a long, long, long time. But I think for now, what's more interesting is you can start looking at, well, you can learn a heck of a lot about how Down syndrome produces the various problems it produces. I mean, people with Down syndrome are more prone to childhood leukemias. They get early onset Alzheimer's fairly swiftly, quite a high percentage. And what you might be able to do is things like take out stem cells from their bone marrow, silence the extra chromosome 21 in those and reinfuse them so that at least as an adult they would have healthy cells in their bone marrow, and it may reduce the risk of this leukemia that can be there. So it's going to be help you dissect what this syndrome is and hopefully address some of the conditions in the nearer term.
Robin, this is incredibly complex stuff, especially to put into humans. It's ethically, you know, it's going to have lots, there's going to be lots of ethical questions, practical problems. This is quite far away from being a human treatment, isn't it?
Yes, it is very far off, but as Ian rightly says, it's the first sniff, and therefore the first sniff is always going to be very welcome. I mean, Down syndrome actually has a great deal to tell us about our about the general human condition. As Ian said, people with Down syndrome are very, very prone to getting Alzheimer's disease. In fact, by the age of 21, every single person with Down syndrome has the tangles that are in the brain, tangles among the neurons that are primarily associated with Alzheimer's. The interesting thing is, today, Down syndrome, people are living until their 40s and 50s and 60s even, which was not the case in the past. And the interesting thing is, we're finding that not every single person with Down syndrome who has these tangles gets Alzheimer's. Some of them do not get Alzheimer's. So what is going on? There is a key there. There's something to teach, you know, for general medicine. And it's quite good that for the first time, general medicine may be reciprocating and saying, we may have something back here to give Down syndrome. The particular trick, of course, is by the time these people with Down syndrome are born, they may suffer irreversible intellectual lack of development. And it's hard to see how this treatment would do anything to put that right. The wiring will already have been damaged, as it were.
Is this technique useful for other genetic abnormalities as well, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea is that there are all of these disorders where you have an extra chromosome are called trisomies, and there are others. There's one called Patau syndrome where you have an extra chromosome 13, I think it is. There's another one where you have an extra chromosome 18 called Edwards syndrome. And with all of these, the idea is that if you can get cells from patients and close down the chromosome at various levels of development and in various tissues, because you can grow the cells into other tissues, remember, you can see how that extra chromosome is actually causing the problem in that particular tissue and at a particular stage of development. So then what you can do is say, well, okay, we're not going to be able to go around and knock out the extra chromosome in the cells of Down syndrome people's brains. You're not going to be able to do that. The damage is already done, as Robin already says. But, you know, with some other tissues, maybe you would be able to come up with a drug that mimics the effect of it once you've honed down what the effect is.
Okay, well, let's move on from there to the Red Planet. Natalie, you've been looking at a story about the Curiosity rover. We've not had an update for a while. What's it been doing?
Oh, I know. Well, the Curiosity rover has now travelled over a kilometre over the Martian surface, which doesn't sound very much.
It doesn't at all.
It's taking its time.
Even I move faster than that.
I know. Well, it's taking its time because it's got to understand its surroundings and then figure out which instruments it wants to use on which samples. So the two science papers that have come out last week actually are both focusing on measuring the atmosphere composition of Mars, which is really quite cool. It has been done before, but what we've got now is two instruments on that are unrelated essentially, but on the same suite of instruments. But one's a tunable laser and one's a quadrupole mass spectrometer. And they've got the same result of various gases in the atmosphere of Mars. So this is cool because it's not actually that usual in science that we use two instruments and get the same number.
And so that's good. So the fact is that you've now found what's in the atmosphere. Well, so what's there?
Well, okay, the most common, it's carbon dioxide is really the biggest gas there. But there's also argon, oxygen, nitrogen, the normal things we'd expect. But the important thing is here, there was a big long-standing problem of not really knowing what the composition of the atmosphere in Mars was. Because Viking went there in 1976 and measured the composition of the atmosphere. Great, so we had a number, but it had really huge uncertainties on it. So then we went back in, was it the 90s, with Phoenix, and we again measured the atmosphere composition, got a completely different number, which wasn't very helpful. So we had two numbers which completely disagreed. Now, these new results actually agree with the Viking results, but with much better uncertainty. So we know that Viking is probably correct, and for some reason, Phoenix was just a flyer. It was a bad result for whatever reason.
But this goes beyond now just monitoring what's there at the moment in Mars. I mean, you can start to use this information to reconstruct reconstruct the past to some extent.
Exactly. So these numbers can go into models to try and figure out the past climate on Mars. So they knew that there was this catastrophic event 4 billion years ago on Mars that basically stripped away most of the atmosphere. And then since then, the carbon dioxide and water reservoirs in the atmosphere kind of got established after that stage. So what we now know is that we've got this history for Mars's atmosphere. And it pretty much hasn't changed for 4 billion years, which is another interesting feature. So we can use that to figure out if Mars was cold and wet in the past or warm and wet. And then we can start to actually figure out whether it's got the potential to harbour life, which is obviously the really cool question.
Which is what we all want to know. Exactly. Although Curiosity isn't set up to actually answer that question yet.
It's not, although but it's success, looking for the right conditions.
Successor missions might be doing that sort of thing. Robin, what have you... You love a bit of Mars.
I love a bit of Mars. Probably... Actually, I was at Astrium's laboratories in Stevenage last week, and I saw the Mars successor, the ExoMars robot engineering probe, and I got to drive it over a pseudo Martian surface.
That's very cool.
Stevenage has a pseudo Martian surface.
It has indeed, yes.
I bet it does.
So I've driven a Mars rover.
ExoMars, just to be clear, is the European Space Agency rover that they want to send. It was going to be in association with NASA, but they pulled out.
NASA, who are not the haven't got a good record in cooperating with Europe on space, pulled out once more. And so the Russians stepped in and said, well, we'll save you. It's a bit like drowning at sea and being picked up by the Titanic. Given that the record that the Russians have, I just checked it, and it's 18 attempts and 18 failures. I know 19 failures, because we had Phobos Grunt the other day. So you're going to kind of hope that they kind of really pull the finger out on this
one. Don't be so negative.
I'm going to accentuate the positive. At least we're going, you know.
ExoMars, though, is going to be looking for signs of life, right?
Yes, it will, more directly. It's got the one thing is that it has got, that Curiosity doesn't, it has a drill that can go down 2 metres. And the Curiosity can only scrabble on the surface. And a lot of people think that if you are going to get primitive bacteria-like life on Mars, which is probably what it's going to, the best you're going to get, it's going to be quite deep down away from the ultraviolet rays that bombard Mars's surface. So, you know, if it gets there, you never know.
Natalie, do you get to work on ExoMars?
I hope to in the future. But I mean, really, my work relies on having samples returned from space, because really, we've got the best instruments on Earth. We can't send the kind of instrument I work on into space. It weighs 2 tons. It would just cost a fortune. So for us to bring samples back is really where my research is a kind of lending itself to. But actually, the cool thing about this Curiosity data is that we've got a bunch of meteorites on the Earth, which we didn't really know where they came from. We thought they were Martian because they've got some interesting signatures of argon gas within them. And actually, we've now pretty much confirmed from these new results that these particular meteorites are Martian, which is very cool because it means everything else within those meteorites, all the different minerals, obviously also came from Mars. So it's not just the fact that we know, you know, the gases were on Mars, everything from that rock formed on Mars. So it means on Earth we can start measuring these using lots of different instruments and get really precise results and try and figure out more about the Martian surface and the interior of Mars and how it formed.
Ian?
I think one thing that's interesting is that NASA had a meeting in the last week or so where they were looking at what science they should do with the follow-up rover to Mars Curiosity. You know, they want to send a copy.
Yeah, Mars 2020, is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah. And what's interesting is that NASA is basically bending over backwards to ensure it does not look for life on Mars now. And it seems that there are instruments you could put on a follow-up rover that would look, that would do what ExoMars wants to do and would look to see if there was life around at the moment. But it seems that there's quite a reluctance to do that. And I wonder if it's because, I mean, one of the NASA people said, well, if we can say that there was once, you know, that Mars was once habitable, that's front page news as much as we found, you know, life on Mars. I mean, it's not true, but that's what this chap said. And you think, I wonder if they just think there's nothing there. So really, we just need to focus on whether there was anything, it was even potentially habitable in the past, because otherwise it's not sustainable. But it does interest me how reluctant they are to look for anything now. I think they've probably decided there's nothing there.
You know, as we wait for the royal baby at the time of recording, I do wonder if there was life on Mars found or evidence for it. What would get onto the front page that day? It would be a very strange news editing decision. Anyway, it's a weird hypothesis.
Isn't that sad?
No, that's exactly my point. That's exactly my point. That there would be a pause in a news editor's sort of thought process to think, which one do I put on the front yeah. of the newspaper?
Most of the news editors I know are mostly full of pauses in the thinking
process. Well, let's just wind up then, Ian, with one more story about T-Rex, the most fearsome of the dinosaurs, which turns out might have been a predator or may not. I don't know. What's the story?
Well, it's kind of one of those arguments that doesn't really...
I mean, I thought it was a predator.
Only exists in certain people's minds. I mean, this was a paper that came out last week, which was saying we have incontrovertible evidence that T-Rex was a predator. And then building on this idea that of there being this sort of great debate over whether T-Rex was a scavenger or a predator. And people have said, well, you know, it was too slow, too bulky to chase anything, and it had pathetic arms and things like that. But and so this evidence, which was lovely, was dug up in South Dakota, which from like 66 million years old. It was a T-Rex tooth lodged in the tail, the mid-tail region of a hadrosaur, and which is pretty, you know, damning proof that a T-Rex had tried to chomp on a hadrosaur. But you know, a lot of people I spoke to said, well, there is no debate about whether T-Rex was a predator or a scavenger. It did everything just like any kind of predator you'll find in Africa now at the moment does anyway. If it walks past an animal that's just been killed, it's not going to pass it up to spend the rest of the day chasing a gazelle. It's going to just, you know, it's going to be opportunistic. And so I think this is very media-friendly, black and white sort of, you know, issue to have. Was it a, you know, was it the predator of our schoolboy posters, or was it a scavenger, you know, which just diminishes it all?
In Jurassic Park, it was definitely a predator. It was chasing people about and everything.
Yeah, I'm not moving from that view.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's I think it's safer.
It's in Jurassic Park.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, it's just that it's just safest to be scared of these things. It's got massive teeth.
When in doubt, T-Rex coming for you, go the
just
other way.
Just go the other way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but really, though, I mean, there is no debate. What was the purpose of the paper, apart from just the fact that they found a nice fossil?
Well, I'm not sure that...
I'm not saying they should have purposes beyond that, by the way.
How can I put this? I'm not sure the paper got into the first journal it was submitted to. but it was very interesting and very good and lovely. Now, you know, it was just, here's some great evidence. It was valid to put that evidence in the scientific literature, I think. But I mean, it doesn't tell you, you know, the T-Rex may have just been annoyed and taken a chomp at a hadrosaur as it went by because it pissed it off. I mean, it doesn't mean it was necessarily chasing it and trying to eat it.
Or it was falling over and it couldn't put its arms out to
its one tooth
fall.
In one tail.
So it just like, you know, bit a hadrosaur on the tail to break its fall. Anything could be possible. We don't know. Anyway, let's leave it there. Thank you very much, Ian, Natalie and to Robin. For all those stories, please go to guardian.co.uk/science. That's all we have for you this week. We'll be back next Monday, but from me, Alok Jahar, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.